Welcome to Online for Authors, where I, Terry M. Brown, author of character-driven fiction and host of the podcast, introduce readers to characters they'd love to invite to lunch by interviewing authors, discussing their books, learning about the writing process, and even, on occasion, chatting live with a panel of authors to discuss topics relevant to both readers and writers. My guest today on Online for Authors is Fran Hawthorne, author of the book I Meant to Tell You. Although she has been writing novels since she was 4 years old, she got sidetracked for several decades by journalism. I Meant to Tell You is a contemporary women's fiction with some forays into the history surrounding the demonstrations during the Vietnam War era. More importantly, it is about a woman named Miranda who must come to terms with her past, both the past she has tried to keep secret and the past that has been kept secret from her. Fran made me think about what I would do to keep my mistakes hidden from others, or what others might do if they found out about my skeletons. She also made me consider how I would handle learning about someone else's secrets, especially if those secrets were meaningful to me. Can love survive the past? And when is it okay to tell a few white lies to gloss over the details of the past? I Meant to Tell You may just have the answers.
Today in Online for Authors, we have Fran Hawthorne. She is the author of I Meant to Tell You. Welcome, Fran.
Oh, Terry, thank you so much for inviting me.
And
congratulations on the launch and changes in your show.
Oh, thank you so much. I am super excited to have you. You and I have been talking back and forth for some time now. I don't remember how we met. Did we meet LinkedIn?
We met via Instagram because we seemed to have a mutual connection. And then we continued through LinkedIn until we finally actually started exchanging real emails.
Real emails, and, yeah.
You, in fact, wonderfully introduced me to a number of other podcasts. I don't know if I should say that.
That's good. That's excellent. The more the merrier. I mean, I think that when we can find ways as authors to get our voices out there, you know, that's what we need to do. So I'm glad that I was able to help you do that.
You were. Thank you.
Yeah, wonderful. So before we get really into things, give our listeners just a quick overview of what is this book about? If you were to give us the little elevator pitch, what is this?
Oh, you know, I should have had it ready. Well,
that's okay.
So Miranda and her fiance, Russ, it's very important to them to have a great cause to make the world better. And Russ thinks he's got his perfect job as an assistant U.S. attorney. He's going to be investigating business corruption. And they joke that as part of the FBI vetting, there might be a problem because her parents were anti-war activists in the 60s. But it turns out in the course of the FBI vetting, a different problem emerges. It turns out the FBI discovers that Miranda had been arrested for felony kidnapping 7 years earlier, a little detail she had never bothered to tell her fiance about. In the course of figuring out what's going to happen to their relationship, Miranda starts uncovering more and more secrets about her family, about Russ, about her former best friend.
And it goes from there. Yeah. It was a very intriguing story.
Thank you.
Where did the idea come from?
Oh, okay. This is a long explanation. I apologize.
No, this is great. I'd love to hear the backstories of novels because I know as an author, there's always some tale that brings us to a place where we now have a character or a story or a setting or something.
So it starts, okay, I have a large family, a number of wonderful cousins, a lot of them. And, you know, we talk about family stories. And so I was always grown up and told that, a great aunt of mine had never married, lived with her mother all her life because she was mentally ill. And this was back in Poland, in the 30s. And then my cousins said, no, that's not true at all. Actually, she did get married and she had a kid. And then my mother said, well, actually, it wasn't that she was mentally ill. It's that she was divorced. When divorce was such a horrible scandal back then that it would was considered more respectable to be mentally ill. And, you know, so everybody had different family stories. And there's no way that we'll ever know the truth. The great aunt, my great grandmother, they were murdered in the Holocaust. And the other next generation, you know, my parents, right. I mean, they're gone. And so we'll never know. And it doesn't change my life, of course, one way or the other, what the truth is about my great aunt. But it just got me thinking about how family stories got passed down and the different versions. And you know, when I would talk to other people, everybody, I mean, maybe you do too. You've got this story that you didn't know. And then it turns out grandpa had another wife and a whole different family. This one comes up a lot with friends.
Right. Well, so the one in my family is my grandparents never celebrated their wedding anniversary. And they always talked about how my father was born 2 months premature. Except that he wasn't premature. He was an 8-pound baby. Eight-pound babies are not premature by 2 months. And they didn't celebrate their wedding anniversary because when you counted, there wasn't 9 months between when they got married and when he was born. And they just kind of like just that's what they said. He was born premature. And then they just never brought it up again. And they went to their graves believing that. I'm not believing it, but like portraying that out to us, even though my dad knew the truth. Us kids knew, I mean, everybody knew, but you couldn't talk about it because it was not, it did not happen.
Yeah, that, again, you hear that a lot too,
yeah.
You know, or, you know, that turns out someone does a DNA test and, but the person they thought was their dad isn't their dad. Yeah. I mean, you know, and
we have one of those in the family too.
So it just got me thinking. And so I came up with a 4-generation family saga that would be told in reverse chronological order that would essentially start with Miranda and Russ, then go to Miranda's parents, the 60s activists, then Miranda's grandparents, then her great-grandparents. And I started writing it. I was completely overwhelmed. You know, I had the 2 generations, Miranda and then her parents, and it's already like, you know, 400 pages. Oh my God. And the research I would have to do, because I'm right. A former journalist and I do my research. I mean, in this book, there's a scene when Miranda and Russ walk across the Arlington Memorial Bridge in Washington, D.C. and then have a fight. And I walked across the bridge and I took notes on how high the fence comes and what the benches are made of, because if they're going to sit in a marble bench, it better be a marble bench. Anyway,
right.
So if that's the easy research, imagine going 4 different generations back 100 years. And, you know, my agent said to me, Fran, why don't you just cut this in half and just do the first 2 generations or the 2 newest generations.
Right.
And I said, oh, well, that's a thing.
That sure makes it easier.
You know, and so there's, you know, I know Miranda's grandparents and great-grandparents really well because I thought about them and mapped them out, which means I know Miranda, my main character, much better than, for example, I did in my first novel, because I know her family history like I know my own.
Right.
Like
right.
Most of us don't know our friends' family histories. And I think that helps make her a richer, fuller person, you know. At any rate, that became, I have to do this book.
Right. I meant it to.
And I don't know, you know, I might write the other 2 generations. Someday.
I was going to ask if you're still considering using that information that you started gathering.
You know, I have just finished a different novel and started yet a different one. So not immediately would be my answer, but you know.
You never know, right? Yeah. Right. So let's go to the research aspect, because I tell everyone that I'm a research junkie, and I use that as a hashtag all the time, because it's one of the reasons I really love writing my historical fiction, is because I get to do 2 things I love, research and write. And I can get kind of stuck in rabbit holes and find all kinds of information I'm never going to use because, you know, I've started diving in, right? What was your research like? Like, you talk a lot about the demonstrations and things that were going on in the 60s and early 70s. What kind of research did you have to do to come up with the realities of those demonstrations?
Yeah, I mean, I am younger than her parents. I wasn't, but I have been in some demonstrations. So some of it, when her mother advises what to do if there's tear gas, I mean, I remember getting that advice. You know, soak a handkerchief in vinegar, I think. But, you know, other than that, I did, depending on the research, in some cases, I mean, there's some scenes that take place in Columbia University in New York. Mm-hmm. So I went there, you know, and I walked around and I took copious notes of what the sidewalks are made of and how many levels of stairs you climb up to, you know, get to the top of this building where, you know, speeches were taking place. I mean, much, I guess you said much more than I would ever need, but so that I'm comfortable describing the scene. And in addition, you know, we have the internet.
That the most wonderful tool?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I can't imagine doing some of what I'm doing right now without the internet. That would be so hard.
And I was lucky enough, for example, in searching the sit-in at Columbia, I found a picture of a flyer that was actually given out there. So I was able to quote from that flyer and describe it, you know, so that was, and then to the degree possible, I interviewed not so much about the demonstrations, but there are other scenes that take place in a part of Brooklyn where Miranda's mother, Judith, is growing up, mm-hmm. a part of Brooklyn called Flatbush. And so I interviewed people who had grown up there at the same time. And I mean, they told me the stores they went to and the buildings, you know, what the insides of their apartments looked like and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And then since I live not that far from there, I'm a runner. I go running every morning. And so I started doing morning runs along those streets with my little, you know, with my phone, you know, dictating, you know, right. notes to myself. Okay, so you turn left here on, you know, East 18th Street, and then you'll see these buildings, you know, because the buildings are pre-war. They go back, you know, before the
Right.
So that's just some of the different kinds of picayune.
Right, right. And so you kind of immerse yourself in it. And then you seem to do what I do, which is then pick out those details that are going to make your story move forward, because you can't use everything you find.
But I want to know more than I use. I did as a journalist, yes. and I want to now. So that, right, exactly as I said, I can feel comfortable. And honestly, I went back to Columbia 3 times, despite all my notes. And it's easy. I live in New York City.
Right.
And I went back to Washington, D.C. twice. And I don't live there, although it's not that far from New York. Again, to take detailed notes, you know, just exactly this metro station. So where are the stairs in relation to this? Because when he drops the flowers.
Right. Is it, does it make sense? Does
I mean,
it
I
make
know, sense? I know. Somebody is going to find a mistake, I'm sure. You know, I'm sorry.
Well, and that's what I tell people too. I said, you know, I do a lot of research but I'm not a historian. And there may be an error. There may be something that I didn't catch because this is not, I didn't live it, but I do my best. And I try really hard to make sure that like products that are being used actually existed. You know, I have a scene in An Enemy Like Me where I have him putting Brill cream in his hair and I wrote it. And then I thought, this is 1939. I know Brill cream was around after that. Was it around in 39? It was. And it became really popular in the mid 30s. So by 39, he would have had access to it. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that my mind stops and says, oh, maybe I need to put something else in his hair. What did they put in the hair before Brill cream? Well, let me find out if Brill cream even existed. You know,
I was going crazy trying to figure out. So a lot of the book is set in 2003. Well, wait, so were people really using laptops and bringing them home? You know, definitely people use computers at work, desktops, right. as we would call them back then. You know, and okay, everybody had cell phones, but what about smartphones? You know, and it's funny, 2003 is the modern era, but it's not.
It's not
2023.
Yet. Exactly.
You know,
and so there are differences, and you do have to, you know, I've had people say to me, Terry, no one would ever know if Brill Cream was around. And I said, but I would.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be a reader who's going to call you out if you've made a mistake like that. You're going to have that reader. And I don't know. I feel like as someone who's writing fiction, but trying to do it in a historical setting, that I need to make my historical setting as accurate as I can. That's, you know, my characters get to do what they want because they're fictional, but they have to do what they want within the confines of this setting that I've put them in. And I can't just pretend, you know, you talk about Columbia University and you can't just make something up. You can't put them at a building that doesn't exist or have them standing on these tall stairs that aren't there.
Yeah. Or, you know, again, I had to find the timing of, there was a student takeover. It was a major, major action at Columbia. And what days, how many days did it last? When did the police come in? Yeah. All of that.
Right. Because if you're going to have your character involved, but not involved. So the Miranda's mother is at that one. And she's involved, but she's not involved like gets arrested, and she's not involved like she's there for any of the big details. So you have to know when would that have been, so that you can put her in and pull her back out again without too much problem, right?
Yeah. And then right. And right, the arrests that do occur in the book, and we're not going to go into details, well, I researched, and they based on real people who got arrested. And these were the actual charges.
Right. Right.
And these are the actual circumstances. I absolutely. Yeah. You know, and so, I mean, it makes me feel good. It's the fun part. And, you know, let's face it, at least for me, maybe not for you, researching is much easier than staring at a blank screen and writing.
Right. Well, and, you know, I love both of the processes. I have to sometimes remind myself, you've done enough research for now. Yes. Start writing. Do research along the way. Like I try to do a lot of back end research, you know, front end research before you really get started. But then I need to get writing, because I could research and research and research and research and use that as my excuse to never write.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm a very different. Okay. When I create the premise of my book, there's certain basic research that has to be done to make sure the premise works.
The premise is going to work, right?
Okay, but then I just start writing, and I have another page up on my screen, you know, my laptop says research needed for chapter one, and it's full of the 3 pages long research needed, so that I'm not going to get. Sometimes I will get slowed down into the rabbit hole that you said, and I'll start Googling and go, get back to your page. Yeah. So, because I don't need research, as you said, for my characters' personalities.
Right? Exactly.
And their dialogue. Exactly. Well, dialogue, if it's historical, you have to make sure the slang is right, but you don't need that for the immediate emotions and interactions of the dialogue. So I just get it down. Then I go and do the research, and I do the research by topic, needless to say. You're not going to go back and forth, library, you know.
Right.
So you do it. I do it by topic. And as I insert the corrections into the book, that's a form of revision.
Great.
I'm not just changing a word. I'm changing paragraphs, you know. So that's my first revision, is the insertion of the research.
We do things a little differently. Yeah. I do a lot of research at the front. And then I tend to research, like, I'm putting Brill Cream in his hair, and I stop right then. And it's like, I go and look that up. Or if I'm really on a roll, I don't have a document up. I actually, this is where I use a notebook and a pen, and I'm writing it out over here to the right. Write that up.
Your first draft you're writing, or your research needed?
The research that I'm needing. I'm writing on a notebook over to the side, like look up Brill Cream, or look up whatever, or find out. My problem is sometimes I'll come up with a solution And I'll think, oh my gosh, I'm not even sure that that can happen. And then I do have to stop.
Yeah, that's what I talk about, the basic stuff. I'm writing into that now with the book I'm writing now, my fourth novel. I may have to violate my rule. Sometimes research involves talking to people, not like my friends who grew up in Brooklyn, but experts. And you usually get one shot at the expert. So that's why I like to say that till I have
to the end. The whole draft.
Yeah. I have all the questions for right. a particular expert. So that's the debate that's going in my head now in novel number 4. And so I'm still plugging ahead on the rough draft with the figuring that I may have to really drastically change a certain plot line, but I know enough to know that the
basics will work.
It is fun in the middle of writing a draft. Sometimes I do get, I've got to go. This will be a really quick Google search. I'm just going to do it. Sometimes I do that and we need breaks, right?
Right.
At least I do.
Right.
So it's a break.
I've done that before where I've been looking for something and it's like, no, that isn't going to work. Oh man, what am I going to do? And then I'm still looking through trying to figure out, and all of a sudden I'll get a new fact. And that new fact is like, oh, that's my answer. I can use that instead. Yay. And then I go on. So I'm a bit of a pantser. So a lot of times I'm writing along and it's like, oh, I've just backed myself into a wall. I've got to figure out how to get out of here. You sound maybe like you're more of a planner.
Oh, yes and no.
Yes and no. So you're an in-betweener.
I cannot start a book without an outline. Okay. I do need that. And sometimes my outline for the chapter will be, just trying to think, I don't think of an outline. I'm trying to think of the outline. Wes and Miranda joke about her parents and, you know, he says, oh, what you would tell me if there was anything. And she goes, yeah, right. Chapter 1. Okay. I can say that it's chapter 1. I mean, the book begins with a prologue, but
right.
That's all I've kind of said. That's what I know has to happen. That doesn't fill an entire
chapter. Doesn't fill an entire chapter. Right. Right.
So
right.
There's plenty I have to fill in, but I need to know how the plot is moved along in each chapter because I have to make sure that there's a logical progression, that I don't leave things out. Then what happens? Is that outline get changed in the revisions, you know? Not even in the revisions, in the first draft. I mean, pantser, I've never heard that, but I like that.
Pantser is just seat of your pants. You know, it's that.
The characters, for me, and I'm sure for you, because for every novelist, they have their own lives. They take on their own lives. They start talking. They start walking. I wasn't planning it. Let me see where it goes. Sometimes they walk into walls of their own volition.
Their own volition, right. You
know, or they start walking and talking into a subplot I hadn't expected. All right, let me see if it works.
Sometimes I tell people all the time that I have voices in my head, you know, and they definitely are talking. And I have gotten to places before where I know where I want this book to go. And my characters do not want it to go there. Yeah. And they refuse to play with me. They just, you know, and nothing is working. And I finally kind of let go of that and go where my characters are pushing me. And I find a much better thing than what I had in my mind. You know, I had this thing and my characters are standing over there going, no, we're not playing. We're not going there with you.
I have to let them go where they want.
Yeah.
Sometimes it doesn't work. You know. Right. And you roll them back and then you go, okay, well, my original idea wasn't going to work. Their idea doesn't work. Okay. Time for a coffee break. Yeah. research break.
Exactly.
But you know, it's a collaboration. I just thought of that between my characters and me.
Yeah.
Neither of us is in charge.
Yeah. It's kind of like you're both just going through this, I don't know what it's a process together and things sometimes work and sometimes they don't. And then you say, well, that didn't work. What else could we do? And yeah, it's a crazy, I don't know, when you're writing, So you type like I do, right? So you're on a computer writing, not handwriting. Have you ever been reading what you're writing and be surprised by what you see coming up?
Not exactly in that way, but yeah, I'm surprised by what's coming out. I mean, I guess so. I guess the way you phrased it, you know, that's kind of when the characters have taken over.
Yeah. Or yeah, I don't know. It's almost like I know I'm writing it and thinking it, and I'm the one that's putting it on the page. But as I'm reading it, I'm surprised, almost as though I didn't know that's what I had just written. I don't know. There's something that's like, there's two parts of your brain. There's the part that's actually doing the creating. And then there's the part that's like reading it and enjoying it. And they're two separate pieces. I don't know. It's very crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of Flashing, for example. So Miranda has a best friend, Ronit. She's helping right. Ronit kidnap Ronit's daughter. That's how the prologue, I'm not really giving right. anything. And so there's backstory. We have to go back and explore how this happened. And all of a sudden, anecdotes about how Ronit and Miranda first met and something Ronit did to help Miranda. It just came out from my fingers. And wow. You know, that they show so much about these two women and their relationship and why they would get to this point. And I didn't plan it. And it's wonderful. If only the whole book would write itself.
I know. Way. I know. I love those moments where it's just like, oh, wow. I had, so my third book's coming out.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And so I'm really excited about that. But when I got to a scene that I knew this is what needed to happen, but it was a very difficult scene to write. And I just didn't really want it to happen. And so I kept trying to come up with an alternative. And I didn't write, and I didn't write, and I didn't write, and no alternative is coming. And I am feeling completely unable to even wrap, like, how am I going to wrap up this whole thing? It's just falling apart to pieces. Oh, what am I going to do? I finally wrote the scene. I said, fine, I'm writing it. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, right? I'm just going to write it. And it was difficult to write. And when I was done with that scene, I was done writing for the day. It was like, okay, I'm that's it. I woke up the next morning and everything else like opened up. I knew where everything was going. I knew how everything was going to wrap up beautifully. It all fell into place. And I almost feel like my characters were saying, we told you, if you had just written the scene 2 months ago, this would have all happened then. You know? But they were keeping things from me because I wasn't willing to write the scene for them. And they're like, we're not going along with you until you're done. You know? So.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, it can be just as productive, as I'm sure you know, to write whatever, 1,000 words and throw it all out.
Yeah.
And save 10. And that can be a very productive day. You know, and that's, it's hard to tell yourself that.
It
you
is.
Know, so like, I'm just trying to think if I had, in some of my books, I've had scenes that were very painful, like yours, and I didn't want to write. Well, this one, yeah. Definitely there was.
Feel, there were several scenes in this book that I could feel pain. There were several. Now, I don't know that they were painful for you to write, but they were painful for the character. And I felt her pain. So sometimes in those scenes, it's difficult to write them, at least for me, because I'm pulling up my own pain to give to my characters so that it's real. And sometimes, depending on what kind of mood I'm in, that can be really hard. But there were several times, I can't give it away because it would tell too much, but there were several times where I felt Miranda's, you know, utter pain at what is going on.
Well,
there's a point with a picture. There's a point with a picture. And yeah, I was just like, oh my gosh. Yeah. So.
Well, thank you. Because that means that my characters were real. They reached you. I mean, that's the most wonderful thing a novelist can hear or fiction writer can hear. Thank you. Wow.
Yeah, no, your characters were very real. I felt very connected to them. I felt very connected to both Miranda and her parents. Like I just felt the connection the whole time. I loved the book. I had no problem reading it. It was a lot of fun reading it. So this was your second novel?
Right. Second published novel.
I mean, we all have the ones in the drawer, right?
Okay.
And what's number three?
Well, I don't like to talk about books until I have a signed contract.
Right.
I won't really talk about three and four. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But
three and four are out there and you're pushing for them to come.
Well, four I'm working on.
You're working on.
And right. It was so wonderful to have this interview. It was an excuse not to get into this. The chapter in four that I'm working on is one that is hard to write not having seen the particular locale. So it's, it's hard. Because the other thing I was going to mention is I act out my character's actions. So if someone throws something hard and it shatters, I'm not going to throw it and risk injuring myself, but I am going to pick an equivalent item up, see how it feels to throw it, so that's probably a bad example, but, walking, I mean, I walked the exact routes in Washington and in New York, that my characters walk, things like that.
Like describe like, okay, so I'm surprised and I try to like look surprised and then look at myself and say, what's going on in my face? How would someone know that I'm surprised? What am I doing?
Yeah. Yep. Or I move my arms, my body.
And what would you call this? She's doing this and like, what would I call that? It's interesting. It's kind of, I think that if people were watching me in my office, they might actually try to medicate me, but that's okay.
You have to be careful. Like I said, that's the other thing. I was staring hard at cars on one of my walks because there are things with cars that I have to describe in a certain amount of detail in the book. And I'm walking around the streets of New York, peering at cars, inside cars, what would people think of
me? And then pretty soon you got a cop following you because you look like you're about to.
Yeah. Well, then there's the cop scenes in the book too. Going to the police station and taking notes and what the lobby looks like. You can't do all your research by watching Law and Order. No,
it doesn't. No, you can't. That's true. What genre would you say I meant to tell you? What genre is that?
This is amorphous genres. Contemporary fiction, women's fiction, upmarket women's fiction. Those are the most common. Although I did get interviewed for a website called Chick Lit Central. So
it's a Chick Lit.
The questions were fun. They asked me who would I want to play in the movie version for my novel. And I said, oh, thank you. Jennifer Lawrence, Channing Tatum, that's it, Miranda and Russ. Who was her mother? I'm picturing her in the movie about Queen Anne and the movie about her lost daughter. I can't remember. Anyway, Olivia, what? That was fun.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of, believe it or not, historical fiction, because they now say anything from 1970 back is considered historical fiction, which hurts my heart just a little tiny bit because that makes me historical fiction and it's a little hard. But
there is a huge section of the book that I should do this. Indeed takes place in the 60s.
Right.
And very early 70s, as you said. I think it's misleading to call it historical fiction because people would expect the whole book to take place in the 1920s, 1830s. I don't even know.
Right, right.
So I don't call it that, but you're right.
It has an element to it. It's like My Sunflowers Beneath the Snow starts in the 70s, but comes through to present. And yeah. So, you know, they've been labeling it sometimes as historical fiction, often as women's fiction.
I'm going to say saga. I think if it goes through a stretch like that in the family also, that's the other thing, which mine is also in the same family. It could be called saga.
It could be a saga as well. Yeah.
No.
I think, you know, that's one of the things I've found as an author that's really harder than I thought it would be, is determining what genre I'm writing in. Because I don't feel like I'm a genre writer. I write a story and then I have to look and say, okay, now which of these many buckets is it going to fit into? Yeah. As opposed to, I have a friend who's a cozy mystery writer and she knows that she's writing a cozy mystery. Mm-hmm. And there are subgenres of cozy mystery, like the foodie ones and the, you know, if they're set at the beach or if, you know, and they have these different. So you kind of know when you get started. And with me, I don't know. I have a story and I write it and then I sit and think, where are we going to put this one? You know?
My stories, my novels, the four of them so far, anyway, are centered on family relationships, focusing particularly on the woman, middle class, professional, but with a huge other component. I mean, my first novel, The Heirs, had a huge component, Holocaust related, second generation Holocaust, Holocaust guilt. This one has a huge component about social activism. Do we have a responsibility to the world, to make the world better, to our fellow humans? You know, so it's not just family novels.
Exactly.
Family
exactly.
Drama. And that's important to me too, I guess, to have more than one theme, more than one train to the novel.
Right. Right. Well, and you know, I have the same thing in An Enemy Like Me. You know, it's a World War II genre, but when you read it, you see a lot of the xenophobia, the fear of anyone who had a German past who's living in the United States, and what does that do to communities and families? And, you know, people were changing their names in order to be more American, in order to avoid any kind of persecution for having German heritage. You know, so you and I have some similar ideas that we have this story that we're telling, but there are underlying themes that we're trying to like push out there so that I like people to think. That's what I enjoy. And I liked your book for that reason, because it does make you think. You have to say, well, what would I do if?
Yeah.
You know.
I think it makes the book richer. And also, human beings, we don't have just one thing in our lives. You know, we are not just, I mean, I'm a mom and I'm a writer and I'm a runner and I'm a museum tour guide, by the way. And, you know, I have many things, and obviously some are more important, you know, than others, but we have a variety of.
We do. And I think that most people have something in their life that is very important to them that they'd be willing to fight for, or that they'd be willing to talk about, or whatever. And so I like to find those kinds of themes and explore them, because to me, when you're reading, it's a very safe place to start thinking about things like, I don't know, racism or other things that's very difficult to talk about in a public setting with other people, because people get very, they dig in their heels wherever they are, and they get very, I don't know the words that I want, but you know what I'm saying? And it's hard. It would be very difficult to have some of these conversations. But when you're reading a book, you can try on the different personalities of these different characters, see where you stand, see if you like that. Imagine what it would be if you had a different upbringing or whatever, and you can do things that you might not be able to do in a group setting with people, because you don't have the same fear of, well, what if they found out I had this thought? You know, it's okay, you can have it, it's private, and you can like try on the different characters. So
that's so interesting. Try on as if you were this character or that character.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do. When I'm reading, I'm always the character, whoever is the one that is currently talking, who's currently involved. I am that character. I have become that character. I'm feeling what that character's feeling. And if I don't like it, then I'd like to pull back and ask why. Do I not like it because it's not my values? Do I not like it because it's uncomfortable? Do I not like it because they hit a piece of truth about me that I don't want to admit? You know, is that something I need to look at again? Should I reevaluate my life a little? You know, those kinds of things. I love books that make me do that.
I think that's fascinating that you really become the character you're reading. But or can it be more than one character per book?
Oh, yeah.
You skip to whoever's point of view.
Whoever's point of view it is, if they're written well, I can go back and forth between them. Every now and then there's a character that I can't become. She or he is so far removed from me, probably more in value system, that I have trouble actually becoming the character, but I can become very close to them, like almost their best friend standing next to them, watching them go through this, as I want to scream and shout and shake them and say, you know, what are you doing now?
I mean, the best thing doesn't happen to me with every book I read is when I continue the story after the last page, or I change it. I come up with new plots. Yeah.
Yeah. Or you know, what's happened now? Like, what is Miranda currently doing today? You know, we know what she was doing when we left her. What is she doing now? You know, those kinds of things. I love that. There were a few times now I was able to be Miranda without any problem, but there were a few times that I wanted to shake her. She goes and does something, and I'm like, what are you doing?
Good, because
I was her, it was like I felt like I was scrambling backwards, like, no, we're not gonna do this. So I love that in a character, because the very first character I tried to write, my very first manuscript, which will never see the light of day, the character was so perfect. I couldn't give her any flaws. Like, everything that hit her, she just had a perfect response. And it's a horribly flat, that the concept of the story is not a bad concept, but the way I executed it was horrible. But, you know, I was learning. I was figuring things out. And so it's okay. But it's because I had her, I mean, she was like Superwoman. Everything that hit her, and she had horrible things hit her, and she would just come out looking like a shining star. And you can't love a character like that, because after a while you get to kind of hate her. Like, she's just perfect. Like, nobody's like that. I don't like her. I wouldn't want her as a friend. I mean, you know, and Miranda was not perfect.
Yeah, I don't think I could write a perfect. Well, okay. I hope that I'm a good enough writer that I could write anything. So I suppose with effort, I couldn't write a perfect character, but I don't know anyone perfect. I don't know what it's like to be perfect.
No. So I tell people, I think the reason that happened is when I first started writing fiction, I had just gotten out of a 14-year abusive relationship.
Okay.
And this was this dream that I had been afraid to do, because writing fiction is scary, because you're putting yourself out on this page. And if people don't like it, you know, it hurts, and you have to have a safe place to land. And I didn't have one of those. I was in this yucky relationship that, if I had been hurt on the outside as well as on the inside, I mean, I just couldn't do it. So I start writing, and I think I needed her to be this super person who, no matter what came her way, she was going to be able to battle it. And I think it was my own insecurities of, like, can I be out here on my own, and can I be doing this? And so I wrote this character who could, you know, and so I understand where she came from, but it is not a good character.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a character anyone would love. Maybe someone who just got out of an abusive relationship could love this character.
One thing I deliberately did with Russ, because maybe because I'm a woman, right, and he's the love interest for my main character, you know, her fiance, and there's a tendency maybe to design the love interest as really handsome, because after all, I want readers to like and respect my main character and shake her sometimes. But so, well, you'd want to trust her judgment in who she falls for. So you want this guy to be good. So I had to deliberately make sure that he has plenty of faults as she uncovers his secrets. But from the start, he's not perfect. And what I deliberately did, this guy has a sweet tooth, man. From chapter one, he's eating his Entenmann's donuts, and he's got a little belly, and sometimes there's crumbs on his sweater. And I just deliberately did that so that he's not.
So that he wasn't this. Yeah, he wasn't this, you know, 6'4", dark, handsome, gorgeous man who was perfect. He was like those people that we fall in love with. That have that, right? I mean, you know, most of us fall in love with, you know, an average Joe that has touched us in the right way, and that's why we're in love. And it isn't because it's the movie version of average Joe.
Right. Average movie Joe. Yeah, right. Yeah. Because, you know, right. Ken to come up, go back to a recent hit movie.
Exactly.
Which, speaking of themes, had a lot. The Barbie movie had a lot more to it than a Barbie doll. You
know? Right. And I think that's.
I enjoyed it. It was great.
I think that's what I love about literature is you can, if the author is a really good author, then you're going to get more than just a story. There is the story, and you can enjoy it for the story, but hopefully you're going to be getting more.
Not only that. To add to the that, because I agree with you, and I said I try to have bigger themes.
Right.
If you write a really good book, even a good book, there are things in there that you didn't intend that readers see. And I want to say readers have said that about my book, and I don't want to say, well, I write really good books. But that's just another wonderful feeling when someone says to me, and I notice that, you know, in the first chapter, he does this, and there's this, a reverse echo of it in this other chapter. Oh,
I didn't know I did that.
Yeah. Oh, you know, or something like that.
It is interesting. And it makes me think about my English teachers when they used to say, you know, like, well, they made the curtains blue in this living room to signify. And as an author now, I think, they made the curtains blue because they looked up, they had blue curtains in their own room and decided blue. And it just happened to fit the theme, or do you know?
Or, which is very common with me, because I'm a fiend about not repeating the same words over and over in the paragraph or page. And if he is wearing blue jeans, because that's what he's wearing, then I don't want to use the word blue in the page. And if I have to have a color, and I do want my curtains to have a color, I want my scenes to be vivid, they're not going to be blue. Right. And if we already know that something else has to be green or whatever, and
then you can't have green curtains either. Right.
So, you know.
Right. And so sometimes it isn't because I was saying to myself, ooh, I'm going to create this scene that has this vibe to it. It's because blue was the best color choice given everything else blue. And sometimes it's literally, they're blue. Like, I didn't even think about it. Just blue curtain came to mind, and that's what I wrote.
And the characters, what color curtains would they choose for their house? Would they pay attention to the color? You know, everything, I don't know, every word has such weight. And there's a lot of thought.
There is a lot of
thought. It goes into almost every word of my books. And more than people realize, and that's fine. I wouldn't want everyone to be staring at each word. But
it gives it the overall feel. When you're done, if you've thought about these words, then you have the overall feel.
Yeah.
Well, Fran, is there anything that you wish that I had asked you that I did not ask you?
I don't know. It's been great. I'm so touched that the characters were real for you and you wanted to shake them and you felt. And so that's something, did you? Oh, well, no, I don't want to ask any. I appreciate your inviting me and your liking the book.
So how can listeners who want to learn more about Fran Hawthorne find you and get up with you, I don't know, chat with you, be part of your world? How do they do that?
Oh, that's a good question. Thank you for asking. I do have a website, and of course, nothing is simple. It's Hawthorne Writer. So my last name, Hawthorne, then the word writer, WRITER, no dots, no underscore, okay. HawthorneWriter.com. So that's my website. And that also has a way to, you know, reach me. And it's got, that's probably the easiest thing to go to. I mean, I'm on Instagram and Twitter as at Hawthorne Writer, and LinkedIn. And I would love to hear from people. If you, of course, do read the book from your library, from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble, from local bookstore. You know, I mean so much to hear what people think, including the things you didn't like, you know?
Right. And review the books, you know, like getting Amazon reviews really help us.
Yes. Goodreads, Amazon. Yep. And honestly, 2-star, I don't care, you know, just read it. Thank you. Let me know, because I learn from the criticisms, you know, and a wonderful reader said to me, this book is much better than your first one. And don't you want to hear that you're getting better?
Oh, yeah. I had an editorial review on my second book that said that we can see such growth in Brown's writing, right? And it was like, oh my gosh, I've had growth. Yeah, there's something really wonderful about seeing that you're progressing in this field that you want to progress in, right?
Yeah. So, Thank you, guys. Just read.
That's what I agree. Read. Everybody should read. And if you don't like me as an author, you don't like Fran as an author, find an author you do like. There's lots of authors out there. There's lots of good books. So, you know. All right. Well, thank you so much for being on today, Fran.
Thank you, Terry, and be well.
Thank you for listening to Online for Authors, where I, Terry M. Brown, author of character-driven fiction and host of the podcast, introduce readers to characters they'd love to invite to lunch. Tune in next Tuesday for another podcast episode.